Okay, welcome everybody. I think we'll get started. Sounding very loud here. For those of you that don't know me, I'm just waiting until everybody's quiet. Thank you. So for those of you that don't know me, I'm Jenny Lyon. I'm the current president of the Actuaries Institute. And welcome everybody to this session, which I hope is going to be really, I'm sure is going to be really interesting. So just in terms of my interest, I guess, in the area of gender diversity in particular, I was thinking about it in terms of my introduction, what was I going to say? I think part of the reason I'm here is because having thought about what I was going to do at school and then at university, and I did maths, and I did that, I think, because girls typically didn't and I could do it, so I thought, oh, well, I'll do that. And then when I was thinking about what to do afterwards, I really just wanted to work in business, again, because lots of women didn't have senior positions in business, and I wanted to have a profession. So I started the actuarial exams, see whether I'd pass any or not, and then sort of continued from there. So I think I've maintained an interest in women's influence in business. So I'm particularly excited that we're here to talk about that sort of thing today. And I was at a meeting this morning, which is actually someone who's done some research on diversity and investment management, Yolanda Beatty from Mercer, and they've pulled together some research and a report to look at how women are represented in the investment management field. And in fact, 76% of that field is male and 24% female. So, which is, we're better than that, 33% of our members are female. But in the investment management space, they're having a 50-50 entry point from university and people who are doing finance, and yet they're not seeing the throughput going of people moving through the industry. So they're looking at ways of attracting women into the field and then in how they're going to help to promote them further. So whilst I was at that meeting, I came across, was introduced to this website, which is has just been set up. It's called F3. Fostering Females in Finance. It's a very recent website. I just suggest people go and have a look at it. It's something that, as I say, I literally came across it this morning. I think that perhaps what they're hoping to do is encourage girls at school and university to think about going into finance. They're going to partner with different sorts of associations. So I think that the Institute could look at being involved with this initiative. But really, we're here to hear from Nicolette, not from me. I could talk for ages about this, so I'm going to stop there and introduce Nicolette, who's going to talk to us about her book, which she's written, called Not Guilty, which is a guide for career mums, which she wrote last year. And you've all read about Nicolette, I'm sure, in terms of her background. She is our vice president and will be president of the Actuaries Institute in 2019. She's worked in senior roles in financial services and worked on a part-time basis in those roles. And I think that's where she brings us a really unique viewpoint of how her career has progressed. So I'm going to hand over to Nicolette, and then we're going to have some discussion at the tables too. If you are making a comment, can we ask that you press the button on the microphone? Not so much that we can hear you, but because it's being recorded. So we'd like to record your questions. So I look forward to an interesting discussion. Thanks.
Thanks, Jenny.
Liz, help.
Firstly, good afternoon, and thank you so much for coming. I'm hoping that we have a table captain on each table. Do we have a table captain on each table? Liz might know. Yeah, put your hands up if you think you're a captain. Okay, we're just missing one over there. Oh, yeah, great. Can I just ask you for 2 minutes to introduce yourselves to everyone on your table? I'm going to ask you at various points to share some of your personal views on certain subject matters. So it might be good that if you know their names and maybe where they come from. 2 minutes. Oh, yeah. Will you take one from the back as well? Yeah. Will you take one of the room? Yeah, I wanted one for my Facebook page. Thank you. Okay, I'm assuming we all know who each other are now. Thank you very much. This is always the trick, is how to cut off the conversation once you've started it. I can see that's going to be a challenge. Welcome. There's lots of spots down the front here. I did this in Melbourne yesterday. I created like a naughty table down at the front for everyone who arrived late. So I'm going to talk to you about career mums and this subject of not guilty. And I thought I would start just by telling you a little bit about my mum. So my mum actually loved art at school, but she was encouraged to do something practical when she left school, and she went to secretarial college. And she spent the first 10 years of her working life working as a secretary in London. She then went on to have her four children and didn't work in the formal sense for about 16 years. And then in 1983, my family emigrated from England to South Africa. I was 13 at the time, and my mum was about 42. And my family came under a bit of financial pressure as part of that move. So my mum ended up going back to work, and she ended up setting up her own business. And she set up an insurance broking business. And she went on to employ my brother, my brother's wife, and my sister. And it is now a thriving little family business, and she's still running it today at the age of 74, actually. It's business as usual, with the exception that she takes a nana nap every afternoon. So there's three things that we can learn from my mum. Firstly, she started a brand new career in her 40s, and it was a career that has spanned, you know, effectively 30 years. She took 16 years completely out of the workforce, and you know, these days we worry, can I take the full 12 months of maternity leave, and what impact is that going to have on my career? The second thing we can learn is she worked part-time for a lot of the time that she was building that business. And the third thing, most importantly for this session, is she managed to be both a great mum and have a great career. I'm just going to pause there and get a bit of feedback from you, you know, on this subject of career mums. So firstly, hands up who would consider themselves a career mum? Yep, okay, good spread there. Is there anyone who thinks that they will be a career mum at some stage in the future? Yeah, okay, we've got a good splattering there as well. Anyone who manages career mums? Yeah. Anyone who reports to a career mum? Yeah, couple. Anyone married to a career mum? Yeah, here we go. So it's good for me just to get a bit of a feel, but I'm hoping I will talk about the subject of career mums, but I'm hoping it will have some relevance, you know, in whatever aspect of your life. A particularly warm welcome to the men in the room, because very appreciative that you're here. And please, so we're going to have some time for table discussions. We're going to have some time at the end for questions. But please stop if you've got particular comments about an area or questions. You know, please stop me throughout. So my starting point on this is that I believe that we are well on our way to achieving gender equality in the workplace. Now, that's not a very popular statement to be making at the moment, because some of you would have seen that, you know, there's some stats that say that we're still 150 years away from true gender equality. But when I look at my own experience, I believe that I have been treated equally in my career. And, you know, we don't have enough women on boards and in senior positions. We still have a gender pay gap. But I'm very optimistic with there's a lot of positive momentum that I see at the moment. You know, we've got CEOs being much more vocal on this. We've got targets being put in place. We've got HR policies, a lot of companies rolling out flexible work policies, that sort of thing, unconscious bias training. At one stage at CBA, both my boss and my boss's boss were female, and more than half of the Colonial First State board was female. So once you've actually seen a scenario like that, it does, you know, give you cause for optimism. And I thought that was actually the first question that we should consider in your tables. Do you ask yourself that question and share your views on whether you think you have had equal opportunity in your careers. And then I'll ask the table captains to report back and just give me a sort of feel for the table of generally yes, generally no, mixed, that sort of thing. Over to you. Okay, can I ask you to wrap that up? Very obedient, thank you. This table gets the brownie points. Okay, We're going to go to reporting back mode. I'm going to ask Jenny, because she's been such a pillar of society, to lead the. Remember to press your buttons, everyone. Great. Yeah, excellent. This table. Bit of lingering doubt. Okay, good.
Our table was born between generational life. More we didn't agree, and the younger we were, the more we were actually ashamed of the fact that it was an opportunity to be. I think we had four of us old ones about, but had real issues with the effect of care of them, but there is disparity.
Yeah. That's a good example. Yeah.
We are a very diverse table here. We've got a lawyer, we've got two men, and an actuary. So we had an interesting conversation. From my perspective, being an actuary, I said no. I didn't find it at all. In fact, there was a reverse. Living in South Africa for my first 2 years of my career, being a white male was a really bad thing, and being a woman helped out. So I had to complete opposite. And then we had Michelle, who's a lawyer, saying yes. In the law profession, there is.
And a younger lawyer, I might point out.
I forgot, yeah. More diversity. And then I think the two men are saying not perfectly, but there are, you know, girl clubs in other ways.
Yeah.
Girls clubs and girls clubs in other ways.
Yeah. So, yeah. Great, thank you. Table at the back there.
I think generally we found that there was equal opportunity, but there was a lot of input about choice, whether you wanted to take that opportunity or not.
Yeah.
But also felt that some companies were not there than other companies.
I think that's very true. Right at the back. Yeah, okay, that's good to know. Elaine?
Our table was mostly yes, but we did the one that the difficulty we observed was coming back to work part-time after maternity. Not always easy for equal opportunity at that stage, because people who work with me to be able to deal with it. The company is able to deal with it, so that's where our table found there was not equal opportunity for coming back to work after the shift leave.
Great. So generally quite positive, with a few caveats on that. And it was interesting in Melbourne yesterday. Generally there was they did think that they had equal opportunity. And it was interesting thinking about, well, it's sort of largely a bunch of actuarial women, and in that very specific demographic, it's quite a positive experience, which is interesting for me overall. I've had a positive experience from that sort of gender equity point of view. But I actually think that this balancing a career and motherhood or fatherhood might be an even more wicked problem than that of equality. So my experience has been that it is hard, very, very hard, much harder than it should be, and probably the hardest thing that I've had to do in my life. And I've now got some sort of images that sort of convey some of those feelings. The first thing is being stretched, you know, stretched to the point that you think you're going to snap. And there's the email box that keeps ballooning. There's the to-do list that keeps going round in your head. And now we've got this concept of the thought load that we've discovered that many women, even those with house husbands, seem to bear this thought load, which is around logistics, where your kids are at each point in time, what they're supposed to be doing. I don't know if you remember that Britney Spears song, Piece of Me, but that's sometimes how I feel, just a lot less sexy. So, you know, each kid wants a piece of you, your husband wants a piece of you, your boss wants a piece of you, you know, even the dog wants a piece of you. Then there is this rushing, always busy, never a spare minute in the day, and every minute of the day allocated to some chore or action item. So I was really happy to see this book, The Rushing Woman's Syndrome, and credit to the author for identifying this as a syndrome, because I think she is spot on. And I'll just read to you a little bit about what she says. Women are wired, many of them are tired too, tired yet wired, and this relentless urgency, this perception that there's not enough time, combined with a to-do list that's never all crossed off, is having such significant health consequences for women that I had to write a book about it. And what she does in the book is delve into the health consequences of what we are doing to ourselves. And this describes me to a T. I use every scrap of the day like an Italian farmer uses all of the pig. Then there's the physical exhaustion. For me, that is, you know, usually about 8 o'clock at night where I just hit a complete wall and, you know, want to collapse. There's the guilt. Guilt that you're not delivering 100% at work. Guilt that you're not being the best mum possible. And, you know, some people ask me why I called the book Not Guilty. But anyone who's actually been a career mum completely understands why it's called Not Guilty, because it can be such an overwhelming emotion. I think many of us have mastered the art of the swan, the graceful and serene on the surface and the madly paddling underneath. And it was my sister that first pointed out that I was a swan. And it was one of those cutting yet insightful comments that only sisters can make and get away with. And to me, that's almost the humorous side of being a career mum, the rushing, the being stretched, the everyone wanting a piece of you. There's a much darker side to it, and I've had close friends go through all of these. Extended periods of illness, like chronic fatigue away from work. Anxiety, depression, marriage breakups, and, you know, just fundamentally unhappy children. In my case, I have to very much watch my stress and anxiety levels. And I've actually come to identify what I call the early warning signals of that stress. And they are things like headaches, so repeated headaches, not sleeping well at night, you know, broken sleep patterns, sometimes even heart palpitations. And my absolute favourite is memory loss. Just when, you know, you've got so much going on in your head that you just completely start forgetting things altogether. And those to me are signals that you've just taken on too much and you need to rein things in and start saying no to things. So it does bring us to this question, how can we have it all, given all of those challenges? And given my background and strategy, I was inclined to try to think about this subject strategically. My strong view is there is no silver bullet. There is no single piece of advice that you can give a new career mum or your daughter that will make it all go swimmingly. I very much think that you need a holistic solution. So in my case, I ended up working, I've really worked flexibly and part-time now for about 14 years. I got pregnant with my first child about 2 years into my general manager of strategy role at Colonial First State, and I knew that I wanted to work part-time, and I fully expected to lose my general manager role in order to work part-time. So I was absolutely thrilled when my boss agreed to me working part-time and keeping that GM role. And that was really unusual at the time, and to some extent still is, to have a part-time general manager. So the way that I chose to structure it was to actually come in every day and work 7 a.m. till 1 o'clock. And I did it that for a few reasons. The first one was actually a personal reason, that I'd rather have half of every day with my new baby girl rather than some days when I wouldn't, you know, see her at all if you do the sort of traditional 3 or 4 days a week. I also thought it would be more acceptable to my boss if I was there every day and something urgent came up. And it had another advantage, which was that I wasn't... Sometimes when you work part-time, you can feel invisible. Is there anyone who works part-time? Show of hands in the audience. Yeah, we've got quite a few, actually. So sometimes you can not get it copied in on emails, you can get not invited to certain meetings, you know, you can feel like you're not really part of the team, and I effectively avoided that. So I did that arrangement for about 8 years in total, and then very slowly over time I morphed into what I called flexible working, where the kids were now at preschool and school, and I was working the 40-plus hours a week. I had a new role, general manager of retirement, and I was trying to pick up the kids from school 3 days a week. And then I was catching up on the work in the evenings and on the weekends. And I did that arrangement for 4 years. So the first thing is I had a lot of support from my employer. So over that time, that 12 years at CBA, I reported to 4 different CEOs who all supported my arrangements, although I'm particularly grateful to the first person who said yes to it. When I look back on that sort of the part-time, the 7 till 1 versus the flexible working, big tick for the part-time work, it worked really well. The flexible working, where I was doing the 40-plus hours a week, I was so grateful for the job that I was doing that probably would have done anything, but it was much harder on me personally, and I felt like I was working 7 days a week because I was working 7 days a week, and you know, I don't think I could have kept that up much longer than the 4 years that I did that for. The other thing that I quite consciously did was in my own mind, I put my career on hold, and I very much sort of focused on the children, particularly in those early years. And effectively, my career went sideways probably for about 10 years when I look back. Now, some people might think, oh, that sounds a bit archaic. Why can't you work part-time and still progress your career? But I have to say, I was very happy with the overall arrangement. The only times that I wasn't happy is when one of the other general managers got promoted above me. And then you would think to yourself, you know, I'm more senior than them. I've been here longer, I'm more capable. And there's no doubt that that did sting a bit. But I would just take a deep breath and I'd think to myself, what am I doing and why? What are my measures of success? I've got all of the, you know, I've got this time with my children. And it would be sort of a short-lived period of pain, if you like. And then over this time, I just began to realize that I had a growing, you know, friends, female colleagues, number of women who were working part-time in senior roles. And I began to realize that it was a growing sort of social phenomenon. And I just began to observe what I saw them doing well, how they were managing this whole balancing act. And the other thing that happened is... a number of women just used to ask to catch up with me for a coffee. And invariably, they would be about 6 months pregnant. And they would want to have a chat about negotiating part-time arrangements with their boss, managing their relationship with their boss, you know, how to do the childcare arrangements, how to manage things at home. So we used to have a really good broad-ranging discussion. But in quite a few of those cases, it just used to strike me, I think, oh gosh, I think you're thinking about this too late. You know, I know your boss, he's never going to agree to part-time, or I know the job that you're doing, that's going to be difficult to do flexibly, or you are just in the wrong company entirely. and, you know, I just thought, wow, you know, we should be thinking a bit more strategically as women about how we approach this. And that's where the motivation to write the book came from, partly it being, you know, so hard, how hard I found it, partly this, it's an unfolding social phenomenon, you know, around us, and partly this thought that we, you know, just seeing women and leaving it too late to really think about things. So when it came to sort of bringing all of these learnings together, I wanted a framework that captured the strategic nature of the problem, but also the holistic nature of the solution. And given my background in strategy, I decided to use this McKinsey 7S framework. And here you have permission to think this woman is a complete Fruit Loop, totally OCD, and that probably is true. Has anyone heard of the McKinsey 7S framework? A few nods. So it's basically a business strategy framework that you apply normally to a business to map out the kind of way ahead. And it's been around for decades, actually. And it's got these seven S's, strategy, system, style, that you sort of go through. So I applied that to the life of a career mum. So I'll just give you a bit of a flavour for what I mean. The first S is shared values. So normally shared values is about corporate culture. And it's at the centre because it sort of binds all the S's together. But I chose to look at the shared values between a career mum and her partner. And are you on the same page, and are you really clear about what's going to make you happy? So I think the first question we have to ask ourselves is, does work make me happy? And I haven't heard this put better than by Shonda Rhimes. And I was lucky enough to see her last year at the main TED conference in Vancouver. And she is a self-proclaimed titan of her industry. She is the writer behind Grey's Anatomy, How to Get Away with Murder, and Scandal. You know, the woman is phenomenal. And she put it like this, when I'm hard at work, when I'm deep in it, there's no other feeling. And she calls it the hum. The hum sounds like an open road. I could drive it forever. The hum is a drug. The hum is music. The hum is God's whisper right in my ear. And, you know, you can see she's a writer for a start off. And, you know, I think that really captures it. When work is going well, that's how you feel. And now we've got a lot of empirical evidence to suggest that women who do both roles, home and formal job, have higher rates of mental well-being, lower rates of depression than women who purely stay at home. I think the next question we have to ask ourselves is more money going to make me happier? This is some data based on Gallup data in the US, and they asked people the day before whether they had experienced happiness, enjoyment, smiling and laughter, did not experience worry or sadness, and did not feel stressed out. And they then mapped that data against annual income. And what they found is that under $75,000, as income increases, those measures of happiness all increase. But after $75,000, they actually plateau out, suggesting that once you're earning $75,000 US, that increases in income after that do not actually lead to increases in happiness. And I don't know about you, but that $75,000 was a lot less than I thought it would be. People have asked me, only the actuaries, is that after tax? I don't know. So if more money's not going to make us happy, what does make us happy? And luckily now there's been a comprehensive longitudinal study out of Harvard trying to answer that exact question. And this guy, Robert Waldinger, is actually the fourth director of that study because the study has spanned 75 years. And what they did is they tracked 700 men, half of them Harvard graduates and half of them from some of the poorest parts of Boston. And they tracked everything about them, you know, their health, their, you know, financial situation, their achievements, et cetera, et cetera. And the key conclusion out of that study, good relationships make us happier and healthier, period. So no mention of fame, no mention of fortune, achievements, just good relationships. And I think it's such a good reminder for career mums because, you know, I have a belief that work sucks you in, and I've been, you know, victim to that myself in the past. Before you know it, you're working the 14-hour days, you're working weekends, and the irony is that we're sacrificing the one thing that is going to make us happier, which is these relationships with our loved ones. So there's three more questions that I think we should answer. And, you know, I would very much encourage people to have these explicit conversations with their partner. In a lot of cases, I didn't. These guys know my partner here, so they probably understand that. Slightly uncomfortable, but you can understand why. Don't tell them. So first is, what's more important to you, parenthood or your career? So try and answer that question in your heads. If you had to pick one, what is the most important? And the interesting thing from a data point of view, we've seen a seismic shift towards career and away from, you know, motherhood or fatherhood. If I have to answer this question, I still say motherhood would be the most important for me. The second question I think we need to be, you know, much more on top of is, when are we going to start a family? Because I think these issues around fertility have now become very, very apparent. And I look back to a previous job that I had, and we worked in the product and marketing area. And there were a lot of senior women working in that area. And all apart from one of us left having children into our 30s. The one person who had it in her 20s, she had two kids in her 20s, everything went swimmingly. The rest of us all had some fertility issue or other. So a lot of my friends went through IVF. In my case, I ended up having 5 miscarriages along the way. So I had 3 between my first and my second child, and another 2 between my second and my third child. So, you know, that was really, really tough. And it is very tough, particularly maintaining some sort of professional demeanor in the workplace when all you can think about is babies. And the final question that I think you need to ask, and this one even more so explicitly, and interestingly, yesterday in Melbourne, you know, there was one lady who'd gone back to work after her first child and just taken on everything. But when the second child came along, she'd stopped working. She sort of had this explicit conversation with her partner and worked out a much better arrangement. So how much of a role will each parent play in early childhood care? So I'm a big believer in, you know, the give me a child till he's 7 and I'll give you the man or the woman. and also a big believer in that need for one-on-one care in the early years. And I, interestingly, just this weekend, there was an article that came round on Facebook about a study by the London School of Economics. I don't know if anybody saw that. It was a Guardian article, just saying that the biggest predictor of life satisfaction in adulthood is your emotional health as a child. And I think that's something that we all know and understand, but it's good to see sort of stats to back it up. Anyway, I'll come back to this one around childhood care later. So that was shared values and, you know, getting on the same page, asking those hard questions. The next S is structure. And so structure is normally about hierarchy diagrams and org structures. But in this case, I chose to look at, well, how does a career mum structure her life? And this is a quote from Ian Narev, who's obviously had a hard time over the last couple of weeks. But he's been very inspiring on this topic. There is no right model. Ultimately, the key is the choice of the individual and making sure that no matter what choice that individual makes, the organisation can help that person to have a thriving career. We don't want to jam a right model down women's throats. There are as many answers as there are women, and we have to make sure that no matter what choice they might make, the organisation enables that choice and shows that a successful career and self-fulfillment as a parent are not mutually exclusive. So the first thing is, it was just amazing for me to hear the CEO of CBA say something like this and, you know, just be vocal on this subject. And I completely agree with this. We're all individuals. We've all got our own circumstances, and we've got to work out what the right structure is. You know, is it full-time, part-time, job share, house husband, you know, shorter work weeks? Just on that note, does anyone have a house husband here? Part-time house husband, that'll do. All right, we had quite a few in Melbourne, actually. Because, anyone who think who's got the house husband, then your structure, that this box is sort of effectively ticked and you can move on to the next S. I'm also a big believer in this saying from Quentin Bryce, yes, you can have it all, but not all at the same time. And I think at the end of the day, you're going to have trade-offs, and we're going to make those trade-offs either consciously or subconsciously. But it's really interesting to think about what your trade-offs are. And, if I think about my own personal trade-offs, I would have loved to do a CEO role, and I've effectively not done that. I went from a general manager, and then the last 2 years or 18 months, I've become a non-executive director. So I've sort of skipped that, but I would have loved to do that. And the other thing that is one of my trade-offs is, from as early as I can remember, I always wanted 4 children. But I absolutely stopped at 3. I just thought there was no way it was humanly possible to do any more. But it still plagues me. Should I have had that other child? Thinking of adopting an African one now. So this was actually a diagram that I think brings some of those trade-offs to life a bit. I was quite lucky to have a session with David Gonski more than 5 years ago now, and we got onto this subject of male versus female career patterns, and he drew this diagram for me. And effectively what it's saying is men and women initially progress at the same rate. Men go on to sort of reach their career peak, if you like. When women have children, their careers go sideways, which is effectively what happened with me. But he was saying that once you've, sort of got the children done, you can then sort of get back on that career direction. And his insight was that he believed that women actually have more staying power in the older ages, perhaps linked to our longer life expectancy. But that really resonated with me because, especially with my mom, age 74, still running her business. So I thought that was a good way of looking at it. So what is the best structure? I think we're all going to come up with our own structures. The one structure that I think is particularly hard is where you're running 2 full-on careers out of the same house. That is very tough. I am a huge advocate for the part-time work. It has worked really well for me. But a couple of things. There's some stats there just showing that between 30 and 40% of women work part-time, depending on the age of the child. I think part-time, it worked well for me. You can keep a foot in the career door. You can, keep working. And I think it's good for your own mental well-being as well. Interestingly, when I was at Towers Perrin, Jenny was the first. She was sort of one of my role models. Both Jenny and Helen Martin, now Helen Rowell, were the 2 principals at the time. God, in my mind. but they worked part-time as principals at Towers Perrin. And, that was very radical at the time. And, I think it'd be interesting to hear Jenny's perspective. But there was a fair amount of heat and discussion about it. It definitely sort of set my own view. So a couple of things on part-time work. The first thing is, I think a lot of you would have had friends who've had children and then left the workforce and seen how hard it is to get back into the workforce. And partly that's confidence, our own confidence just plummets. And partly it's just the practicality of trying to get a job again. And I recently had a friend who had taken about 4 years off, and she ended up coming back in at half the salary that she was previously on. And I think that's probably an extreme example, but it does illustrate how difficult it can be. So a couple of things about part-time work. I absolutely think job share is the way of the future. And I did hear sort of some advice when I went to a training session in Women on Boards. They said, don't think part-time, think job share. So I was lucky in my general manager of strategy role that it could morph into a part-time role. But I do believe a lot of roles are very hardwired into organisations. So we do have to think job share. I've had friends working job share. I've had a job share PA at one stage. I've had a job share program manager reporting to me. So I'm very convinced that it can work, but I'm also convinced that we are at our absolute infancy in being able to properly structure and support men and women in job share roles. It's very early days. If I project forward for my three daughters, I would love to see a world where the dominant model is where both parents work part-time or flexibly, particularly when the children are young. And I have actually got one set of friends, two actuaries, interestingly, who have done that. So I have seen that work really well. I think if you're both doing 4 days a week, that can actually, or the equivalent of 4 days, it's enough time at work and it's enough time, you know, with your the one-on-one time with your child. So I think that is another good opportunity for table discussion about your experiences with part-time or flexible working. So particularly there's some of you here that do work part-time, but for the others, just sharing your observation of how well or not well it's worked in your work environment and whether it's something that you would advocate or not. Over to you. Thank you. Okay, let's wrap it up there. Thank you. Can we hear back from our table captains? But I do want, there was a great little example here of that we found of someone who both parents are actually working flexibly. So can we hear from you first and then go around to the table captains?
So it's a conversation to have with your employer. So suggest that as a lady, if you're interested in your finances.
Yeah, thank you for that, Claire. Any observations from this table?
So we had some people seeing it not working online. We all like the idea of the job share, although I haven't seen it work in practice, but I would personally, as a manager, be very happy with that concept. Like people to share a job. My experience is I've done 3 days, I've done 4 days, I've done full time, I've done 4.5 days, over 5 days, and now I'm full time flexible though, because I need twice a week to see my kids. And as you say, there's no right answer to where you are at the time and what works for you at the time.
Yeah, thank you. Jenny? Yeah, I do think that is a good thing to call out. Probably the less said about it, the better. Anne-Marie?
One of the things we talked about here was the danger of 4 days a week, doing a full-time job on a part-time wage, and stress, and that's actually counterproductive. Additional stress is within
Yeah.
And then just a personal observation, also with babies and very small children, the juggling. You're talking about quite long days where your alternative childcare is a long day, and then the shock when they go to school or something, you can't want to love it, it's a drop in the
Yeah.
I'm sure I would have school for longer than 10.
Yeah, that is a question I do get sometimes, which is, I'm being paid for 4 days, but I'm working 5 days, what should I do? And I have to say, you know, people will probably not agree with this, but I always say, just suck it up and get on with it, or start doing 4 days. But, you know, because that 1 day with your extra day with your child is so precious that if you do the 5 days, then you just, you know, you're giving up that the time with your children. So even though it does seem like a high price to pay, I think it's sort of worth it. But, you know, I've heard people give exactly the opposite advice, which is work 5 days, get 5 days. But the thing is, if you get paid 5 days, often you end up doing 6 days work. So, yes.
We agreed on the issue of part-time,
rather than him actually being a work part time and actually doing a lot of work over there. And I just want to put that out there. That's a really big issue. I've actually worked very religiously. I've 95 times my career. So I work with my gut down on my work. And I think we need to get away from that.
I think that would be a great other session about this future of work and how, as a manager, you do monitor outcomes, not input.
I think that's been the biggest thing for women is think about having to be at work a long time rather than being productive.
This table. Yeah, very much. Thank you. Back. Yeah, that resentment is something that I experienced. I mean, that no one says it to you overtly. And what I wish I'd done is more actively or proactively communicated what I was doing and why beforehand. And not only just to the people that I was working with and working for me, but the key one, funnily enough, was the PA network. So, one of my key issues was PAs booking meetings in my diary in times that I wasn't in the workplace, and I just look back and I think, gosh, why didn't I just go to them and say, this is what I'm doing, why? You know, they, if you speak one-on-one to them, they'll probably be very understanding. Did you want to add anything, Elaine? Oh, yeah. Thanks, Jenny. Elaine.
Thank you. I just want to add to the comment there around what you accomplished and how to get out of work. I think workplaces have tried so hard in the last 20 years to reset the way they think about their value of their employees. It's not the hours you sit at your desk, 15 hours, things are so flexible, there's all sorts of things you could be doing at your desk rather than work. but what they're accomplishing in those hours. But it's really for organisations to do that. And I, as I've mentioned to you, I did the flexible full-time work for 11 years, and it was absolute hell. Because you're there with your children in the evening, then you've got to start work again, and you work all night, and then you're back at work the next day. And people would set meetings for 6 o'clock at night. And this meeting wasn't even in your calendar until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you're about to go away and go home. And they set a meeting for 6 o'clock. It's mad.
Yeah.
And it's only because the organisation still is organised. If they need any of the meeting, they should have set their meeting a couple of days ago and it should have been at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
So the fact that we actually, at the behest of people that are less organised and aren't getting their act together, really, and makes it really, really hard if you want to get the kid, the other child from daycare at 6 o'clock. So it'd be really nice if we could get workplaces to move more around what you accomplish in the time that you're there rather than the hours you're there. But the fact that organisations have tried to
I am seeing change in that, but it is very isolated. It can be just in particular departments. It's very dependent on the leadership in that area. Yeah. Peter's going to say something.
When I was running Pillow, one of the women working there and the flexible working hours was very important. So when we were negotiating the award, flexible working hours was like the number one issue on the thing. So the problem we had is we wanted to go one step further and we wanted to pay people for output because it was just a processing. So we could pay people $10 for widget.
Yeah.
And so we try to go down that track saying to people, if you can just log in from home, work from home, you can do process some of the widgets and get paid for it. But we had a lot of difficulty getting both the staff and the unions on sides in
really?
Terms of doing that.
Right, right.
So we started, and I think it would have been a great outcome, but we
yeah, right. Right, okay.
So I think there's a lot of internal.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just the unions, it's the staff too. You have to get your head around, because there are people who come to work who don't, are not that productive and prefer to work hours rather than widgets. So, those sort of people will often stop you progressing with this sort of thinking.
Yeah. I would love to have a separate session on that. Yes. All right. Yeah, yeah. I agree. Okay, we better move on. So that was structure. The next S is style. And this is really about a woman's... This chapter actually is very specific to women, and it's about women's personal brand in the workplace. And I'm just going to talk through a few challenges. So I like Jeff Bezos' definition of this, which is personal brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room, when you leave the room. So the first one I'd just like to mention is likability. I think this is something that I have seen in the workplace, which is likability as it relates to very senior women in your workplace. And some of you might have heard of this experiment, but it was done in Columbia Business School in 2003, so admittedly a while ago. But they used a Harvard Business School case study with a lady called Heidi Rosen, who was a venture capitalist. And they described her outgoing personality and vast personal and professional network, which included powerful business leaders in the technology sector. So they got half the students to read the case study in its original form, and half the students read it, but with Heidi changed to Howard. And then they polled the students firstly on the level of competence between Heidi and Howard, and pleasingly they were seen to be equally competent. But when they asked them about likability, Heidi was seen to be a lot less likable than Howard. And arguably this is something we've just seen play out in the US election with Hillary Clinton, and I definitely think I've seen it in the workplace. The only suggestion I've ever seen on what to do about this is to position yourself as being relentlessly pleasant. So good luck with that one. And this is a cartoon on this that I quite liked. The next challenge I think we face from a style point of view is around confidence. And I think we're so much more aware now of how men and women operate differently in the workplace. So the women on average not asking for pay rises and needing to be 95% qualified for a job before we apply for it. But I think that those are reflective of a much more deep-seated issue, which is on average women are less confident than men. And it's certainly something that I've experienced in my career. And I look back to where the low points have been, and the low points were firstly going from school to university. And I'd done quite well academically, but I absolutely thought that I was a fraud, and I thought that I would get discovered when you really had to think at university. And I think I fully expected to fail then. And the other times that I had these sort of low points were on maternity leave. So it just goes through your head, will they want me back at work? Will they need me? Is someone doing a better job than me? What's it going to be like when I return? It just goes over and over in your head. And you'd think in my case, I'd had two kids, gone back successfully, that by the third time you'd be more confident and then you wouldn't feel like that on maternity leave. But I absolutely did. I still, hit an absolute low point. So I was really happy to find this book called The Confidence Code. Has anyone read this one? No. Amazing. So they talk about... They dive into what the issue is, and they talk about the heart of the problem being our tendency to overthink, partnered with our desire to be liked and to please. Women are also more vulnerable to perfectionism, rumination, depression, inertia, and fear of failure. So quite a long list. but what the book does that I found particularly interesting is it delves into what are the reasons. So it looks at genetics, but it really concludes that the reasons for this sort of lower confidence are actually conditioning, so the way we're raising our children, how our brains work, so they look at the difference between men and women and our brains. But most interestingly, I think, is hormones. So it turns out that testosterone is a great hormone when it comes to confidence, and we just generally have less of it. So there's probably not much we can do about this confidence thing, but I wish I'd had that book, when I was 20, and it would just explain to me what was going on inside me that might produce some of the the father-daughter discussion going on. Is Michelle not suffering from lack of confidence?
No, you're talking about my mother.
All right. So I thought this was another good table discussion. Do you agree? Do you think women have got lower confidence than men on average, because there's some very confident women? And is there anything we should be doing about it? Over to the tables.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we'll bring it to a close there, although there's some vibrant conversations going on the table. Okay. Elaine, can we start with your table this time? Yeah.
What we learned out is tricky. We didn't actually know anything yet.
Yeah.
And I even have my own anecdote. I mean, I'm a non-executive director, and 3 years ago, Ian Pollard, chair of Billabong, said to me, "Name your class's mentoring program that the RCB are running." I said, "Oh, no, I'm just a director. I couldn't possibly do it." 2 years later, he said to me, "Applications are open for the next round. You should apply." "Oh, no, I couldn't possibly do it." He said, "By the time you get you're ready to apply, you will be overqualified."
Right.
I'm really glad I did it, but it just shows even now.
That's a great example. Okay, back table. Yeah, great. Thank you.
What should we do about it? I think we should give ourselves permission to be bosses and
Yeah, yeah. There's a great TED talk on that about how we train our daughters to be perfectionists and not brave. Yeah, yeah, good one. I heard Anne-Marie. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
So we write pretty confident on this table, but at the same time, there was a view that society actually has an impact on the way that society is set up. So we really agree with what I'm saying, that there is expectation that men will be more productive, men will be more successful, and therefore that has an impact on the way that women present, and that the confidence is that we've seen on our table was around if they hadn't had children, that your points about, you know, when your opportunity is, they would see that would have happened.
Yes.
Confidence. I actually think what we should do is we should make it more and retain the confidence. Because I do think that again, to Anne-Marie's point, is it a real lack of confidence or is it the way that it presents? And I think sometimes if you just it surprises you, and the more that you do it, the more you put yourself out there, the easier it gets.
Yeah, very good. Oh, do you want to just press your thingy? Yeah, great point. Yeah, very good. Last one.
So we had, an Asian perspective, we had two senior men.
What's it called, men?
talking about having seen this and frustrated with it, that why it is like that. And I mean, my personal experience is, I always felt like I was a quite confident person until it came to getting a job or asking for an increase or a salary increase, and then I just became a 7-year-old little girl, and I shocked myself. And the only way I found was exactly what Ben said, which I faked it. I got my husband to honestly mentor me, told me what to say. I cringed, I died inside, I said it, it worked.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because the one thing that I do is use my husband as a sounding board. And if I'm got a certain situation, I go home and I say, "What would you do?" And I'm always blown away, like what the things that he would do in that situation. You've got to be kidding. But at least it makes me move slightly away from, you know, my sort of little cowardice version. So, yeah. Interesting. You did the same thing. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. So the final aspect of style that I wanted to mention is what I call building up brownie points, and making sure that you're a star at your job before you go on maternity leave. Because effectively you need to sort of, you effectively trade those brownie points for flexibility when you return. And Jack Welch actually put this sort of concept in his book called Winning. You can see he calls it a chit system. You accumulate chits which are later traded for flexibility. And I, you know, absolutely believe in this. And I also, you know, encourage women not to chop and change before they're having, you know, the years in there before they're having children, because you need to build up that trust, respect. You need to get those sponsors on side. So that style, really, likability, confidence, and the brownie points. The next S is skills. And this is a bit about playing to your strengths. Now, in terms of skills, I think a lot of us would be very well aware of this sort of data that shows about why women are good for the workplace. So, you know, you've got every McKinsey study known to mankind that says we've, you know, you get better growth, you get better profit, and you get lower risk. But I think actually we need to really embrace these figures even more, because I think it makes us more confident to be ourselves in the workplace. And it's a little bit actually about your point. And I think back to my first job, which was at a life insurance company in South Africa in the actuarial area. And it was obviously a quite male-dominated area. And I remember just subconsciously taking on much more male behaviours and way of operating, because I thought that that was how I needed to get ahead. Whereas I feel like now I know this sort of information, it just gives you that confidence to be yourself in the workplace. And it allows you to reflect on, well, what skills do women on average bring to their workplace? And I say on average very deliberately, because there's lots of men that bring these same skills to the workplace. But I do think compassion is one, customer focus, team focus and collaboration. And a really interesting one from the point of view of actuaries is risk focus. Women tend to be more focused on downside as well. So I think that we need to bring these skills to the workplace, the skills that we've got by being female and also our own individual skills, and we need to position ourselves ahead of time in the right role. So a couple of years, you know, again, this is about thinking ahead, right role, so one that can be done flexibly, ideally. Right company, one with vocal senior leadership, one with, you know, good HR policies. But most importantly, in my experience, the right boss. And I've seen this time and time again. Women who are working in companies that seem to tick the boxes in terms of HR policy, some of them have even won awards for what they're doing with women. But if you don't have the right direct boss, you cannot negotiate the arrangements that you want. And it's amazing how often I see that. So that was skills, right company, right role, right boss. The next S is strategy, and here I delve into childcare strategy, because I think that's the most important strategy for a career mum and her partner. And I like to think of it as a bit of a jigsaw puzzle. Each of the parents' own time, daycare, nanny if you can afford it, and grandparents. Who's got grandparents looking after them? You are the grandparent, Peter. You did one. Ah, right. So you almost had the entire jigsaw. Any other grandparents over this side? One here. Yeah. So you guys are so lucky. So just remember that. I think that's great way of approaching this. The other thing is, it is this ever-morphing jigsaw. You think that you've got the jigsaw in place, but it actually changes, you know, every year or so. So I try and draw on some of the research in this area, and when you look at the research, it is very mixed. The two areas that you get a big thumbs up for are parental care and preschool. Preschool gets a very big support from the research. Where it gets very muddy is daycare for children under the age of 2 or 3. And I've got just... when I say muddy, that this quote, this is a Steve Biddulph quote, the research is now undeniable that babies and younger toddlers do not thrive in childcare. Care-raised babies don't all become psychopaths, luckily, but they're measurably more anxious, aggressive, disobedient as they move through preschool and the primary grades. So that's one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum is this one. And this was based on a big study out of the US. Children who were cared for exclusively by their mothers did not develop differently than those who were also cared for by others. So when you're given such, you know, research that's so poles apart, you know, what do you do with that? And I think you have to just make up your own mind, and particularly around the needs of your child, because different children will thrive in different kinds of care. There's some stats here on the percentage of children in the various types of care. But, you know, just having gone through that, a couple of observations. Whatever you do, if you have sufficient one-on-one quality time during the day, and that's so much easier if each parent plays a role, then that is what you should be aiming for. And don't overuse daycare as the solution. So it's a good part of the jigsaw, but don't make it the, you know, entire jigsaw. And part of my reason for saying that isn't just the research, but it's also having employed women in the workplace and who come back to work. They might be working 3 or 4 days a week. And just the issues with sickness in daycare, it is... So, you know, they're working 3 or 4 days, the kid gets sick for 2 days, they get sick for 2 days, they're just not there for an entire week. And, you know, coming back to that personal brand in the workplace, it is very difficult to maintain a, you know, reasonable image when you're going through that. It's, you know, very, very hard on the individual.
Excuse me on that one.
Yes.
I'm
sorry, I'm
frozen English.
That's good. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yeah, yeah. A very good segue to this next thing, which is staff, which, and for a career mum, her staff is actually her partner, but I know he doesn't think of himself like that, or herself. And also what you can afford to outsource. So I am such a big believer that domestic sharing of household chores is a critical success factor for career mums. And that extends to exactly what you were just saying. You know, it's not just the household chores, it's the child rearing as well. Now, in my case, I married a South African man. There's a few South African accents, I'm wondering. He is a bit hopeless on the domestic front, as to be said. So this is sort of, you know, do as I say, not as I do. He makes up for it in different ways, which I won't go into. But it turns out that I'm not alone. And if you just look at this, this quote came out of a study which compared men across different countries. And Australia in that study, I think it was an OECD comparison, was the absolute worst in terms of men helping out at home. And we can delve into that a little bit. This is my favourite song at the moment. I don't know if anyone's heard this one, I Ain't Your Mama. Do your own kick. I let my girls listen to this as often as they like, just to make sure it's entirely ingrained. But on a more serious note, this guy is phenomenal, Michael Kimmel. I don't know if anyone's seen or... Yes, yeah, he was out in Australia, actually. So he talks about gender equality, but from the perspective of men. Also a great TED talk that he does, by the way. But he uses research to effectively prove that when men help out at home, the children are better off, lower rates of absenteeism and higher rates of achievement. When men help out at home, the women are better off, lower rates of depression, and apparently they exercise more. When men help out at home, the men themselves are better off. They smoke less and drink less, apparently. And if all of that isn't compelling enough, when men help out at home, they have more sex. So, you know, whatever it takes to try and convince your partner to help out more. I mean, I think this is actually one of our biggest hurdles, actually, in terms of, you know, not guilty. And I thought that was, you know, for our final table discussion, I think that was it's a good area to dwell on a bit. So what's your experience of sharing household duties, whether you're a career mum or not, and how do we bring about change? Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I've just noticed what the time is. okay, instead of going round the tables and sharing, is there anyone that had particularly great insights there? I think it actually was anyone who particularly wants to share anything, because otherwise I'll sort of try and wrap it up a bit. Yes, well, we definitely want to hear from the men on this subject. Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. Yeah.
And then also about the confidence in the workplace and trying to apply that in your home life as well. So women are less confident around house than on the house.
Yeah. Great observation. And yeah, we had that same conversation on that table over there about, you know, we just have such high standards that men just constantly don't meet them, and then you just get frustrated. But anyway. Yeah.
It isn't necessarily high standards, it's you know how you want it done.
Good point. Yeah, sure. Yes, excellent one. Your staff also includes your kids. Good luck with that. Definitely can't speak from experience there.
We need to get kids to help.
Yeah, we do.
Grow up healthy. Because eventually you'll have that kind of workforce
in
time, and I need to be independent.
Yeah.
My brother used
good
to make
point.
Her lunch.
Oh, really? Her brother used to make her lunch. Yes, Elaine. Yes. Yeah. Very good advice. So the other aspect of staff is outsourcing what you can afford. And my general observation is that Australian women are very slow to put in place the domestic arrangements that will support what you were doing in the workplace. We very often just do a job and then keep on doing all of the stuff at home as well and just add it on top. And I come across, I can't tell you how many women who are doing full-on jobs, have children, and then go home, for example, at the weekend and do their cleaning. And it's just not sustainable, and we will drive ourselves nuts in the process. So big plug for outsourcing what you can, as much as you can afford. I think someone was telling earlier about Estelle's quote that as much as you can afford. The final S is systems, and systems is actually just like a company. It's the processes and technology that you need to put in place. And I think technology largely is a career mum's friend. Those are some of the examples of processes. So one of them for me is weekly planning. So I have to sit down on a Sunday night and plan the week ahead. That's something I never had to do before. Getting organised. I think we need processes for managing stress, so scheduling exercise, meditation, whatever it takes.
Medication.
Yeah, the Prozac. And then these were more mindset things. Adequate is the new excellent, which was Lily's point. giving up on perfectionism is a really big thing. Learning to say no and getting comfortable with chaos are all ways that I really had to change my sort of mind shift. So just a couple of concluding slides. The first thing is the risk when you write a book on this subject is that you inadvertently hold yourself out as some sort of model of success. And I just wanted to say that that is absolutely not the case, that I have had as many, you know, dramas, out-of-control moments, arguments, tears as anyone else. A lot of the ideas in the book, as I said, came from actually observing what some of my friends and colleagues were doing well, not what I did. And some of the observations came from what I just did well, more out of luck than design as well, particularly that trifecta, right job, right company, right boss. Looking to the future, if I think to myself, well, what is going to make this more sustainable? How will it be easier for career mums to do this? I think change is needed on three levels. Governments with assistance for part-time work, or incentives for part-time work, assistance with childcare, companies, more companies rolling out flexible work programs, and vocal leadership is so important. But the biggest change that we need at the bottom of the pyramid, I think, is individuals in our own home. I do see we need this massive cultural shift towards greater equality and that sharing of childcare and domestic work arrangements. So in the meantime, I think you can use this as a little bit of a checklist, the 7S framework. And, you know, those of you that are career mums, just go through these and give yourself a bit of a score out of 10. So shared values, are you on the same page as your partner? Have you had those conversations, those hard conversations? Are you clear about what's going to make you happy? Structure, what is your structure, and have you considered flexible working? Style, you know, what's your status on brownie points, confidence, likability? Skills, are you in the right company, right role, but most importantly, have you got the right boss? Strategy, the childcare jigsaw, and have you put your child first? Staff, are you sharing the domestic workload and are you outsourcing what you can? And systems, have you put in place the technology and processes that you need? And in my mind, these are a little bit like the seven legs of a table. So if you've got all seven in place, life can be harmonious. If you're missing one or two, things go a bit wobbly. And if you're missing three or four, then you just risk complete collapse and implosion. So coming back to this question, can we have it all? I think if you define having it all as, you know, being a CEO and having five children, I think the answer is no. But I do think that if we are strategic about how we approach this, and by being strategic, I mean planning ahead, positioning ourselves ahead of time, what are our priorities, what are our trade-offs, and do we have those seven legs of the table in place? If we are strategic in that sense, then we can have the bits of it all that we want. So I am optimistic about the future. And I will leave it there. There's some contact details there, but I'd love to hear for anyone who's sort of passionate about this subject area. My email address is nicolette.rubenstein@gmail.com. Now, thank you. We have a couple of minutes for any final observations, closing remarks that anyone wants to make, and then I can hand over to Jenny. Any burning thoughts? Yeah, one over here.
Gender-neutral conversation about work-life balance, and if we have a broader conversation in gender-neutral time, men are going to be more comfortable with conflict, and therefore it's going to be easier for women to actually get the flexibility that they want. So if we encourage men in the workplace to work part-time when they have new families, it's everyone, and it's not this, oh, I'm a woman, I want this.
Well, and I do think that is the way of the future. As I said, I think the younger generation will look at it more like that, and the younger men will want, you know, will want this balance as well. Yeah, good point. Thank you. Any other final ones? Yes.
I
to one of the things I was hoping would come through as a consideration or perhaps something, an appreciation of the family. It's in my mind that I come from a particular sort of background, cultural group, Anglo group, which has been very, very clumsy and careless with families and communities. We have feuds all over the place. People think they have the option of falling out with their brothers and sisters, their mother-in-laws and whatever, and so they become isolated. The comparison working elsewhere in the world, my actuarial department in Kuala Lumpur, most of my ethnic Chinese staff, they had wonderfully supportive family structures. They bickered and complained and all the rest of it, but my God, did the structure work as a support system? And there was a realization that that was an important thing. You could not afford to operate without that system.
And
people became isolated, were desperately vulnerable.
Yeah.
So maybe one of the crucial things is, if you want any of this to work, you've got to be careful, really.
Yes, and that sort of comes under that structure. And I completely agree with that. We see it in Asia, a lot more supports from your parents, and Africa as well. You know, the normal model in Africa is for your children to be raised by your parents.
The only superannuation system that has worked, and for a new interest in this, is to actually feed grandpa sitting out on the back deck, on the basis that your children will see you supporting him and they'll support you. It's a bit late for me.
Yes, Elaine? Yeah, and you feel like you're leading this double life doing that. But I think that's a good way of putting it, that having it all is all about that accomplishment in both your work and your family. Yeah.
I just said one thing. I'm a single mother,
so that's a whole different subject area, actually, yeah.
One thing, I'm just a kid. I try to get my kids to respect my work, so that they don't know when work is a priority and when they're a
slave labour. Just on that note, I shared the stage just a week ago with a sort of panel session on the future of women and work with two women who had been raised by single mothers, and both of them said they had no feeling of guilt. Guilt did not, because they just expected, because they were raised with a mother who worked, that there was no sense of guilt of not doing that, which was fascinating for me. Thank you.
I think we should finish, sadly. Obviously, everybody's enjoyed contributing and listening to what everybody else has to say. Nicolette's book's too late for me. My children are grown up. But I'll have to hand it on to my daughters and my son so that they, I guess, understand for the future what's needed. I think there have been so many really interesting points that people have made, and it just shows how different people's experiences are in terms of their own personal journey. And I think we have to remember that's, you know, work and home and relationships, it's our life. And so we have to try and make it work best for us. So I'd just like to ask you all to thank Nicolette for a great presentation and insights. Thank you, and thank you for all your contributions too.